stories of imagination are never far. They still reside in us, guiding us ever forward. Join us now as we journey forward into the past. And here is your host, J.C. Rede. Hi, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of Forward Into the Past. I'm J.C. Rede, your host and narrator, and today we're kicking off our holiday episodes here at Forward Into the Past as we delve into a virtual treasure trove of forgotten holiday classics. The end-of-the-year celebrations are my favorites. We celebrate making it through another year together, and oftentimes we reflect on those who didn't make it. It's all part of the cycle of life, which, at this time of the year, is reflected in several of the customs that we have built into our holidays, especially here in the United States. Evergreens are most associated with the holiday celebrations in Europe and most colder climates. Plants that stay alive during the coldest times of the year were always held as magical and powerful in days past. Plants like holly and ivy were, and still are, used in holiday celebrations in England and France. Mistletoe is another plant that's used in holiday celebrations in England by way of the Vikings and Druids. And there is a very special rose which grows in England during this time of the year, and all of these have legends and stories associated with them, and I hope to get a lot of them shared with you. Well, we'll see. One of the most recent additions to the American version of Christmas is the poinsettia, or, as it's known in Mexico, the star flower. There's a wonderful story associated with this plant, and it involves two children growing up in a very poor village in Mexico. The legend of the star flower tells of a girl named Maria and her little brother, Pablo. They were very poor, but always looked forward to the Christmas festival. Each year, a large manger scene was set up in the village church, and the days before Christmas were filled with parades and parties. Now, the church bells in this village had remained silent for many years, and it was said that whoever brought the baby Jesus the best gift in the village would make the church bells ring again. Now, the two children loved Christmas, but they were always saddened because they had no money to buy any presents. They especially wished that they could bring something to the church for the baby Jesus, but alas, they had nothing of value to give. On Christmas Eve, Maria and Pablo set out for the church to attend the service, and on their way, they picked some weeds growing along the roadside to take them as their gift to the baby Jesus in the manger scene. Of course, the other children teased them when they arrived with their gift, but they said nothing, for they knew they had given what they could. Maria and Pablo began placing the green plants around the manger, and, miraculously, the green-topped leaves turned into bright red petals, and soon the manger was surrounded by the beautiful star-like flowers of the poinsettia. And in the distance, the entire village heard the church bells ring for the first time in many years, all because of a simple gift of love from the poorest children in the village. And with that, we begin our first holiday episode, The Shadow of Christmas Present, written by Willis Boyd Allen, in 1893. The Shadow of Christmas Present, Chapter 1. It was at precisely 8 o'clock on the evening of the 24th of December that Mr. Broadstreet yawned, glanced at the timepiece, closed the book he had been reading, and stretched himself out comfortably in his smoking chair before the kennel fire, which snapped and rustled cozily in the broad grate. The book was A Christmas Carol, and the reader, familiar as he was with its pages, had been considerably affected by that portion relating to Tiny Tim, as well as cheered by the joyful notes with which the carol ends. For some minutes he sat silently surveying the pattern on his slippers, and apparently working it out again on his own brow. Now, Mr. Broadstreet was not a man to act upon impulse. A lawyer in large and profitable practice, and a shrewd man of business as well, he was never known to do, say, or decide anything without deliberation. "Hold on a bit," he would say to an eager client. Softly, softly, my friend, you're too fast for me. Now, what did you say was done with the property? And so on to the end of the story. If there was any money in the case, Mr. Bradstreet was pretty sure to draw it out for the benefit of his clients and, remotely of course, himself. When I put my hand down, he was fond of remarking with significant gesture upon the office desk, I never take it up again without something in it. In the course of his long practice, aided by a series of fortunate speculations, he had amassed such a goodly sum that his name stood near the head of the list of our prominent taxpayers. He drove a fine span of horses and was free enough with his money in a general way. That is, when some large philanthropic movement was on foot, Alonzo M. Bradstreet Esquire was pretty sure to be down for a round sum. He paid his share in church and politics and annually sent a check to the Board of Foreign Missions. He made it a rule, however, never to encourage pauperism by promiscuous almsgiving, and never tried a case or gave legal advice for love. Poor people who called at his office for assistance always found him unaccountably busy, and street beggars had long since learned to skip his door on their morning basket visits. Tonight, Mr. Bradstreet had picked up the Carol in a specially complacent mood. He had spent liberally in Christmas gifts for his wife and children, letting himself almost defy his better judgment by purchasing for the former an expensive pin that she had seen and fancied in a show window the week before. Just as he had completed the bargain, a rescript had come down from the Supreme Court affirming judgment in his favor in a case which meant at least a $5,000 fee. Notwithstanding the memory of his recent good luck, he continued, on this particular evening, of all evenings in the year, to knit his brow and give unmistakable evidence that some emotion or reflection, not altogether pleasant, was stirring him powerfully. "Nonsense," said Mr. Bradstreet presently, half aloud, as if he were addressing someone in the center of the glowing coals. "Nonsense," he repeated, looking hard at a grotesque carved figure that supported the mantel. "I'm not like Scrooge. I give freely and I spend freely. That fire don't look much like the one old Scrooge warmed his gruel over, does it now?" The marble figure making no answer to this appeal, but continuing his stony gaze, Mr. Bradstreet shifted his position again uneasily. "Don't I give away hundreds of dollars every year to the societies, and haven't I left them around 10,000 in my will? Won't somebody mourn for me, eh?" But the carved lips replied never a word, only seeming to curl slightly as the firelight played upon them, thereby assuming such an unpleasantly scornful expression that Mr. Bradstreet began to feel more uncomfortable than ever. Rising hastily from his chair and throwing the book down upon the table, he walked on to the window, rubbed a little place clear upon the frosty pane, and looked out. The night was gloomy enough to make the plainest of homes seem cheery by contrast. Since morning, the skies had been dully gray, so that everyone who went out wore arctics and carried umbrellas and was provoked because no storm came. At about the time when the sun might be supposed to be setting, somewhere behind that dismal wall of clouds, a few tiny, shivering flakes had come floating down or up, one could hardly tell which, and had mingled with the dust that had, driven by the biting wind, had filled the air and piled itself in little ridges along the sidewalk and blinded the eyes of men and beasts throughout the dreary day. Before long, the snow overcame the low-born friend with whom it had first treacherously allied itself, laid it prostrate on the earth, and calling in all its forces, rioted victoriously over the field. The storm now took full possession of the city, whitening roofs and pavements, muffling every footfall and wheel rattle, filling the streets up to their slaty brims with whirling mists of sleety snow, and roaring furiously through the treetops around corners. As Mr. Bradstreet gazed through his frosty loophole, with mind full of the story that he had just finished, he almost fancied he could discern the shadowy forms of old Marley and his fellow ghosts moaning and wringing their hands as they swept past in trailing white robes. He turned away with a half shiver and once more ensconced himself in his warm, easy chair, taking up the carol as he did so, and turning its leaves carelessly until he came to a picture of the Ghost of Christmas Present. It was wonderfully well drawn, following the text with great care, hitting off the idea of the jovial, holly-crowned spirit to the very life, and then the heap of good things that lay in generous piles about the room. Mr. Broadstreet could almost catch a whiff of fragrance from the turkeys and geese and spicy boughs. Indeed, so strong was the illusion that he involuntarily glanced over his shoulder at the marble-topped table nearby, half expecting to see an appetizing dish of eatables at his side. No one had entered, however, and the table was, as usual, with its only album and gilt-mounted screen, flanked by a few books that were too choice to be hidden away on the library shelves. When he looked back at the picture in the book, he started and rubbed his eyes. He thought, but it could not have been possible, that the central figure on the page moved slightly, and he was positive that one of the ghost's arms in the engraving had been raised, while now were both at his side. Mr. Broadstreet turned back the leaf with some misgiving and looked carefully behind it. Nothing but blank white paper. Muttered Broadstreet to himself. How a man's fancy does play strange tricks with... Hello! He was once more glancing at the picture when the jolly ghost gave him an unmistakable wink. To say that the lawyer started, was astonished, struck dumb, would be mild. He sat staring at the page, not wholly believing his own eyes, and yet not liking to look upon such a, to say the least, peculiar picture. While he was in this bewildered state of mind, a rich, jovial voice was heard, apparently at a great distance, and at the same time proceeding directly from the book he held in his hands, and, yes, no doubt about it, the ghost's bearded lips were moving.
"Well?"
said the Ghost of Christmas Present, still seeming very, very far off.
Well, sir, stammered Mr. Broadstreet in return.
"You see, I'm not dead yet, although some of your good people on this side of the water pay precious little attention to me."
"Why, really," said Mr. Broadstreet, instinctively arguing to the opposite side of the question. "As to that, I'm not so sure. Now, take Christmas cards now. A few years ago, they were unknown. Now, they're as common as Valentine's."
"Oh, yes," replied the ghost. "I know. You see, I have my room pretty well decorated with them."
The lawyer scrutinized the background of the picture more carefully, and, sure enough, the walls were covered with what at first seemed a rich sort of illuminated paper, but proved to be composed entirely of Christmas cards, many of which he had never seen. Even in the momentary glance he gave, he observed that those which had been taken prizes and had been most largely advertised during the past few winters were tucked away in obscure corners, while several which were exceedingly simple in design and text occupied the most prominent positions.
"Yes," the ghost went on, "the cards are well enough in their way, and so are the other displays and festivities of the day. But it is the spirit of Christmas that you need. Charity. Charity in its good old sense. Open hearts and kind deeds, with less thought of self-pleasing. While these dainty little gifts are being manufactured, purchased, sent, and thrown away, hundreds of people are at starvation's door in your own city. Thousands of people know little or nothing of the real meaning of the day, or of its founder." As the ghost spoke, its voice seemed to come nearer, and at the same time the book grew so large and heavy that Mr. Broadstreet was fain to set it down upon the carpet. He no longer feared the ghost, nor did it seem strange that he should converse with him in this manner. "Wherein are we deficient?" he asked eagerly. "Or what more can we do? The charitable institutions of Boston are among the best in the world. The sky is full of her church steeples, her police and missionary forces are vigilant and effective in their work." The Ghost of Christmas Present gave a toss to his long hair and beard. "How much have you done to carry the spirit of Christmastide beyond your own threshold? Who in this great city will cherish the day and love it more dearly for your warm human friendship and kindly act
until it symbolizes to them whatever is purest and merriest and holiest in life." The ghost's voice, now grown very near, was rather sad than stern, and its eyes were fixed intently upon Mr. Broadstreet's face. Mr. Broadstreet hesitated. With cross-examination he was familiar enough, but he did not relish the part of the witness. So confused was he that he hardly noticed that the book and picture were now so large that they quite filled the end of the room in which he was sitting, and seemed like another apartment opening out of his own.
I hardly know, he stammered. Really, I've spent a good deal of money. My Christmas bills are always tremendous, but I suppose it's mostly in the family.
Mind, interrupted the ghost almost sharply, I don't say anything against the good cheer and merriment at home. But there are many homes within a stone's throw of your chair where there will be no fine dinner, no presents, no meeting of friends, no tree, nothing but anxiety and doubt and despair. Your dressing gown would provide for several of them. Mr. Broadstreet looked meekly at the embroidery upon his sleeves.
What would you have me do? He asked.
Do you desire to perform your part toward making the morrow bright for someone who otherwise would find it all clouds?
Do you wish to plant seeds of love and mercy and tenderness in some heart that has heretofore borne only thistles? To bring a smile to some weary face, warmth to shivering limbs, light and hope to dreary lives? Oh, I do, exclaimed the rich man, eagerly starting up from his chair.
And are you ready to sacrifice your ease and comfort this stormy night for such as they?
Mr. Broadstreet seized his fur cap and ulster from the rack in the hall.
Try me, he cried. I'm ready for anything.
The ghost smiled pleasantly upon him, at the same time seeming to lift its hand involuntarily as in blessing. Then it spoke for the last time.
Hitherto you have known only the bright side of Christmas, it said gently. It has been full of joy to you and yours, but there are those among your fellow creatures, nay, among your very neighbors, who dwell in such continued misery that when Christmas comes, it but reminds them of their unhappy state, and by its excess of light upon others, deepens their gloom about themselves. This is the shadow of Christmas present, and it falls heavily upon many a heart and many a household where the day, with its good cheer and blessed associations, should bring naught but delight. The kind spirit's voice wavered slightly.
I, myself, can do but little to dispel this shadow. It grieves me sorely year by year, but it remains, and I fear I sometimes but make it worse with my bluff ways and keen winter breezes. It is for those who love me most to carry such light and comfort to those upon whom it rests, that it shall be banished, never to return. The shadow grows less year by year, but it is still broad, broad.
The ghost was silent a moment. It beckoned to the other and motioned him to step behind it.
In my shadow you shall move tonight, it concluded in a firmer voice. It shall accompany you wherever you go, and your work shall be to turn it away with whatever kind deeds your hand shall find to do, or cheering words that you may have the power to speak.
It said no more. Mr. Broadstreet, who, when a child, had often longed to peep behind a picture, found himself actually fulfilling his wish. As he drew nearer the printed page, he heard a dull roar like a surf beating upon a rocky coast. He advanced further, picking his way around the pile of poultry and vegetables and glistening hollow upon which the ghost sat enthroned. A moment more, and the room vanished in utter blackness of the night. The roar grew grander and deeper until it throbbed in his ears like the diapason of a mighty organ. A fierce blast of snow-laden wind struck his bewildered face. The street lamp upon the corner flickered feebly in a mist of flakes. He was standing before his own door, knee-deep in a snowdrift and buffeted above, below, and on every side by the storm that was abroad that Christmas Eve.
Chapter 2. As soon as Mr. Broadstreet recovered himself and cleared his eyes from the blinding snow,
he saw a heavy black shadow on the sidewalk, enveloping his own person, and resting upon the figure of a man who had evidently just sheltered himself behind the high stone steps, for his footprints leading from the street were still quite fresh. As the man thrashed his arms and stamped vigorously to start the blood through his benumbed feet, a bright button or two gleamed upon his breast through the cape of his greatcoat. Mr. Broadstreet now recognized him as the policeman whose beat it was, and whom he had occasionally favored with a condescending nod as he came home late at night from the theater or the club. He had never addressed him by so much as a word, but now the shadow was full upon him, and Mr. Broadstreet felt that here was his first opportunity.
"Good evening, officer," he shouted cheerily through the storm. "Wish you a Merry Christmas tomorrow."
"Thank you, sir. Same to you," replied the other, with a touch of the cap and a pleased glance at the great man. "Hard time for the boys tonight, though."
"Yes, it is hard," said Mr. Broadstreet compassionately. "And you're rather cold, I suppose," he added awkwardly after a pause.
"Rather."
"Why, bless me," a bright thought striking him. "Wouldn't you like a cup of hot coffee now?"
The officer looked up again, surprised.
"I would that, sir, yes, first rate," he answered heartily.
Mr. Broadstreet stepped to the side door and pressed the electric knob.
"Bring out a good cup of coffee for this man," he said to the girl who answered the bell. "And, officer, buy the folks at home a trifle for me. Christmas, you know."
As he spoke, he put a big silver dollar into the astonished policeman's hand, and at the same time the shadow vanished, leaving the light from the bright, warm hall falling fairly upon the snow-covered cap and buttons. A muffled roar and jingling of bells made themselves heard above the wind, and a streetcar came laboring down the street through the heavy drifts. Mr. Broadstreet, without a thought as to the destination of the car, but impelled by some unseen force, clambered upon the rear platform. The conductor was standing like a snowman, covered with white from head to foot, collar up around his ears, and hands deep in his pockets. And the shadow was there again. Broad and gloomy, it surrounded both conductor and passenger in its bleak folds.
"Tough night, sir,"
remarked the former presently.
Yes, it is indeed," replied Mr. Broadstreet, who was thinking what in the world he could give this man except money.
"And Christmas Eve, too." "That's a fact," said the conductor. "Just the luck of it, I say. Now tomorrow I get 4 hours layoff in the afternoon, and my wife, she was planning to take the children and go to the play. But they're none of them over strong, and it won't do to take them out in this snow. Besides, it's not like 'twill storm all day."
"Children!" exclaimed Mr. Broadstreet, seeing a way out of his difficulty. "How many?"
"Two girls and a boy, all under 7.
Got any Christmas presents for them?
Don't mind my asking." "Well, I'd just as love to show you what I've got. 'Tain't much, you know, but then it's something."
He stepped inside the door, laid aside his snowy mittens, and taking from the corner of the seat a small brown parcel, carefully removed the string and wrappings.
"There," he said with a sort of pleading pride in his eyes. "I guess these'll please 'em some. 'Tain't much, you know," he added again, glancing at his passenger's fur cap as he displayed the presents on the car seat.
A very red-cheeked and blue-eyed doll, with a placid countenance quite out of keeping with her arms, these members being so constructed as to occupy only 2 positions, one of which expressed unbounded astonishment, the other gloomy resignation. A transparent slate with a dim cow under the glass, and 15 cents marked plainly in lead pencil on one corner of the frame, and a rattle for the girl baby. As the conductor held up these articles in his stiff red fingers, turning the doll about so as to show off her flaxen braid to the best advantage, and inducing the arms to take the positions alluded to, the shadow crept away and had well nigh disappeared. But it returned again thicker than ever when he said, with a little choke in his voice,
I did mean to get him a little tree with candles on it and a picture book or two, but our pay ain't over much, and we've had sickness and...
He was very busy doing up the bundle, and very clumsy he must have been, too, for it was a long time before the wide-looped, single-bow knot was tied, and the parcel carefully put away again. Mr. Broadstreet winked hard, and his eyes shone.
"How long before you pass here on the way back?" he asked. About 35 minutes it'll take us to get round, sir, on account of the snow. It's my last trip.
Very well. Now, conductor.
Sorry. What did you say your name was?
Tryson, sir. David Tryson.
Then, Mr. Tryson, just ring your bell when you reach the corner there, up on the up trip, and dodge into that store where the lights are. You'll find a bundle waiting for you. Good night, Mr. Tryson, and a Merry Christmas to you and yours.
Good night, sir. God bless you, sir. Merry...
But his passenger was gone. As he reached the sidewalk, Mr. Broadstreet turned and looked after the car. Whether it was the light from the street lamp or the broad flood of radiance that poured out from the windows of the toy shop just beyond, he could not tell. But the rear platform was illuminated by a pure, steady glow, in the very center of which stood the conductor, smiling and waving his hand. No sign of a shadow, not a bit of it. Mr. Broadstreet looked carefully about him, but it was nowhere to be seen. Even the snow, which all this time continued to fall without interruption, seemed to fill the air with tiny lamps of soft light. Ah, that toy shop! Such heaps of blocks and marbles and sleds, such dolls with eyes that would wink upside down exactly like a hen's, such troops of horses and caravans of teams, such jangling of toy pianos and tooting of toy horns and shrieking of toy whistles, these instruments being anxiously tested by portly papas and mamas apparently to be sure of a good bargain, but really for the fun of the thing. Such crowds of good-natured people carrying canes and drums and hoopsticks under their arms, taking and giving thrusts of these articles and being constantly pushed and pulled and jammed and trodden upon with the most delightful good humor. Such rows of pretty girls behind the counters, now climbing to the summits of Ararats, where innumerable Noah's Arks of all sizes had been stranded. All these girls being completely used up with the day's work, of course, but more cheerful and willing than ever, bless them. Such scamperings to and fro of cash boys and diving into the crowd and emergings in utterly unexpected places were never before seen in this quiet old city. Mr. Broadstreet embarked on the current, and with an unconsciously benevolent smile on his round face, was borne halfway down the store before he could make fast to a counter.
"What can I do for you, sir?"
If the girlish voice was brisk and businesslike, it was at the same time undeniably pleasant. Mr. Broadstreet started.
"Oh, well, I want some presents. Christmas presents, you know,"
he said, looking down into the merry brown eyes.
"Boy or girl, sir, and how old?"
Mr. Broadstreet was fairly taken aback by her promptness. His wife always did the Christmas shopping.
Let me see. He began hurriedly.
Two boys. Oh, bless me, he went on in great confusion as her low laugh rang out among the woolly sheep with which she happened to be surrounded.
Oh, I've really forgotten. That is,
oh, I see. You needn't laugh. And Mr. Broadstreet's own smile broadened as he spoke. They're not mine. I never heard of them until 5 minutes ago, and I declare I don't remember which is which. At any rate, there are three of them, all under 7.
How would a lamb do for the oldest? Real wool and natural motion.
In proof of which latter assertion, she set all their heads nodding in the most violent manner until it made her customers quite dizzy to look at them. Mr. Broadstreet picked out the biggest one.
He seems to, bow more vigorously than the rest, he said.
The girl then proceeded to display various toys and gay-colored picture books, Mr. Broadstreet assenting to the choice in every instant, until a large, compact bundle lay on the counter, plainly marked, Mr. Tryson, conductor, to be called for. As the lawyer was leaving the store, he remembered something and turned back.
Oh, I forgot. I wanted to buy a tree, he said.
"Just round the corner,"
interrupted the brown-eyed girl over her shoulder without looking at him. She was already deep in the confidence of the next customer, who had told her the early history of two of her children, and was now proceeding to the third. Mr. Broadstreet buttoned up his coat-collar and stepped out once more into the storm. A few moments' walk brought him to a stand where the trees were for sale. And what a spicy, fragrant, delicious, jolly place it was, to be sure! The sidewalk was flanked right and left with rows upon rows of spruce and pine and fir trees, all gaily decked with tufts of snow
Every doorway, too, was full of these trees, as if they had huddled in there to get out of the storm. Here and there were great boxes overflowing with evergreen and holly boughs, many of which the dealers had taken out and stuck into all sorts of crannies and corners of their stands, so that their glossy leaves and scarlet berries glistened in the flaring light of the lamps. Wreaths of every size and description, some made of crispy gray moss dotted with bright amaranths, some of holly, were threaded upon sticks like beads, and were constantly being pulled off and sold to the muffled customers who poured through the narrow passageway in a continuous stream. All brightness, thought Mr. Broadstreet, and no shadow this time. None. Well, then, what was that black, ugly-looking stain on the fallen snow extending from his own feet to one of the rude wooden stands where traffic was busiest? Mr. Broadstreet started and scrutinized it sharply. He soon discovered the outline of Christmas present. Beyond a doubt, it was the shadow again. Chapter 3. It must be confessed that for a moment Mr. Broadstreet felt slightly annoyed. Why should that thing be constantly starting up and darkening his cheerful mood? It was bad enough that the shadow should exist without intruding its melancholy length upon people who were enjoying Christmas Eve. He might have indulged in still further discontent when he noticed the head of the shadow figure droop as in sadness. He remembered the kind ghost's grief and upbraided himself for his hardness of heart. "Forgive me," he said half aloud. I was wrong. I forgot. I will, please God, brighten this spot and turn away the shadow." Without further delay, he advanced through the gloomy space until he reached the box upon which a large lot of holly wreaths and crosses were displayed. He soon completed the purchase of a fine, thick fir tree and sent it, together with a roll of evergreens, to the toy shop, directed like the parcel to the conductor. The owner of the stand was a jovial, bright-faced young fellow, and it was evident that to him Christmas meant only gladness and jollity. But the shadow still rested upon Mr. Broadstreet and all the snowy sidewalk about him. He was thoroughly puzzled to find its object, and had almost begun to consider the whole affair a delusion, when his eyes fell upon an odd little man standing in the shelter of the trees and visibly shaking with the cold, although his coat was tightly buttoned about his meager form and his old hat pulled down over his ears. As he saw the portly lawyer looking at him, he advanced timidly and touched his hat.
"Can I carry a bundle for you, sir?"
he asked, his teeth chattering as he spoke. "Why, I'm afraid not," said Mr. Broadstreet. I've just sent away all my goods." The man's face fell. He touched his hat again and was humbly turning away when the other laid his hand lightly on his shoulder. "You seem to be really suffering with the cold, my friend," he said in such gentle tones that his learned brothers upon the other side would not have recognized it. "And that's a little too bad for Christmas Eve."
"Christmas! Christmas!"
shivered the man, with a little moan, wringing his thin hands.
"What is that to me? What is that to a man whose wife is dying for want of tender nursing and wholesome food, whose children are growing up to a life of misery and degradation, whose own happiness is gone, so long ago that he has forgot the feeling of it?"
Mr. Broadstreet patted his shoulder gently. He said, trying to speak cheerily. "It isn't so bad as that, you know. Times are better, and there is plenty of work."
"Work!"
cried the man bitterly.
"Yes, for the friends of the rich, for the young and the strong, for the hopeful. But not for me. I tell you, sir,"
he continued, raising his clenched fist until the ragged sleeve fell back and left his long, gaunt wrist bare in the biting wind,
"I've walked from end to end of Boston, day after day, answering every advertisement, applying for any kind of honorable employment. But not even the city will take me to shovel snow in the streets. And I'm discouraged.
To Mr. Broadstreet's dismay, the poor fellow suddenly hid his face in his hands and broke down in a tempest of sobs. Ah, how dark the shadow was then! The storm had ceased,
but the keen northwest wind still swept the streets, filling the air with fine, icy particles of snow, and driving to their warm houses those who had remained downtown to make their last purchases. The man shivered and sobbed by turns and was quite the sport of the wind, which was buffeting him with its soft, cruel paws, when suddenly the world seemed to grow warmer. He felt something heavy and soft on his back and around his neck. Mechanically thrusting his arms through the sleeves which opened to meet him, and looking up in amazement, he beheld his new friend standing upon the sidewalk in his dressing gown, a genial smile upon his beaming face and his hand outstretched. The lawyer laughed gleefully at his consternation. "It's all right," he said, as the discouraged man tried to pull off the ulster and return it to its owner. "I'm warmer than ever. Come on, let's go home and see your wife and children. Don't stop to talk." And seizing the other by the hand, or rather the cuff of his sleeve, which was much too long for him, he hurried him off, snatching a couple of wreaths from the stand as he went by and dropping a half dollar in their place. It was a strange experience for the proud lawyer, that walk through the dark streets, floundering among the snowdrifts, slipping, tumbling, scrambling along over icy sidewalks and buried crossings, the long-skirted gown flapping about his heels in the most ridiculous way. He kept his eye steadily fixed on the shadow, which was always before him, now turning down a side street, now doubling on itself, ever growing more and more distinct and drawing its two followers farther and farther into the lowest quarter of the city. The stars were out now and seemed to flicker in the fierce wind like the gaslights upon the street corners. Mr. Broadstreet felt curiously warm without his ulster and as light-hearted as a boy. As they passed through the most brilliantly lighted streets, however, he saw much that filled him for the moment with sadness, for the shadow now grew enormously large and rested upon many places. It brooded darkly over the brilliant saloons that lined the way, and that clothed themselves in the very garments of Christmas to attract the innocent and foolish, so that, drawn by the sheen of holly and evergreen and the show of festivities and good cheer, they might enter and find their own destruction. Oftentimes, too, the shadow flitted along the street in company with some man or woman who, to all outward appearance, was calm and content with life, perhaps even happy, one would have said. In the black folds of the shadow, brutal-faced ruffians hid their bleared eyes. Houses were draped as in some time of national mourning. Once, the slight, pretty figure of a young girl came up, wearing the shadow flauntingly about her neck like a scarf. She stopped and seemed to address Mr. Broadstreet with bold words. As she met his kind, pitying glance, however, her own eyes fell, her lips quivered. She drew the shadow about her face and fled. Alas, he could do nothing for such as her, unless that gentle, fatherly face should come before her again, in her solitude, and, by its silent eloquence, lead her to better things. While Mr. Broadstreet was peering about for the shadow and taking into his heart the lessons it taught, he had not been idle, giving a kind word or a bit of money or a pleasant glance wherever the chance offered. The shadow now paused before a narrow doorway in a crooked little street, and the two, or rather the three, for the shadow went before them, entered and mounted the stairway. Mr. Broadstreet stumbled several times, but the discouraged man went up like one who was well used to the premises. As they reached the third landing, a voice somewhere near them commenced to singing feebly, and they stopped to listen. "It's Annette," whispered the discouraged man. "She's singing for me. It was a way she had when we were first married, and I used to like it, coming home from a hard day's work. So she's tried to keep it up ever since. Do you hear her, sir?"
Yes, Mr. Broadstreet heard her.
Poor, poor thin little voice, trembling weakly on the high notes and avoiding the low ones altogether. It was more like a child's than a woman's, and so tired, so tired. He fumbled in his dressing-gown pocket and turned his head away quite needlessly, for it was very dark. The two men remained silent for a moment, listening to the echo of the gay young voice,
with which the little bride used to greet her husband, she so tender and loving and true, he so strong and brave and hopeful for the future.
"That's a new song,"
whispered the discouraged man again, delightedly.
"She never sang it before. She must have learned it on purpose for tonight."
There was a weary little pause within the room, she wondering perhaps why he didn't come in. Presently she began again, and her voice had grown strangely weak, so that they could hardly hear it in the rush of the wind outside the building. It died away into a mere whisper, and then ceased entirely. Mr. Broadstreet hesitated no longer, but touched his companion's arms, and they both entered. She was lying on a rude bed in the corner of the room, her eyes closed, and her hands folded upon her breast. A look of agony swept across the face of her husband as he knelt beside her, taking her cold hands, so thin, in his own, chafing and kissing them by turns. Above his head on the whitewashed wall was the word John in large, bright letters. It was his name. She had crept from her bed and traced it with her fingertip upon the frosty windowpane, so that the light from a far-off street lamp shone through the clear lines and thus reproduced them upon the opposite wall. Just beneath was "Merry Christmas." She thought it would please him and seem like a sort of decoration hung there above her bed. And now he was kneeling by her side and holding her thin hands. Perhaps he was more discouraged than ever just then.
"Oh, Shadow, Shadow, could you not have spared him this?"
Mr. Broadstreet hung the wreaths he had brought upon the bedpost and waited helplessly. A mist gathered in his eyes so that he could not see. The walls of the little dismal chamber wavered to and fro. The shadow grew more and more dense until it seemed to assume definite shape, the shape of Christmas present, sitting, as before, enthroned, amidst plenty and good cheer. The deep-toned bells in a neighboring church tower slowly and solemnly tolled 12 strokes, and, answered by the silver chime of a clock, the flames of the open fire rose and fell fitfully in mute answer to the blasts of winds that roared about the chimney-top. The ghost dwindled rapidly. The discouraged man assumed the proportions and appearance of a marble figure under the mantel, and Mr. Broadstreet, starting up in a fright, found himself standing in his own warm room, the Christmas carol still open at the wonderful picture in his hand. The air still vibrated with the last echoes of the midnight bell. It was Christmas morning. Not many hours later, the glad sun was shining brightly over the white-robed city, sprinkling the streets and housetops with diamond dust, gleaming upon their golden spires of churches, seeking out every dark and unwholesome corner with its noiseless step, and dispensing with open hand its bounty of purity and warmth. Yet the shadow was there, even on that fairest of Christmas days, and Mr. Broadstreet knew it. Throughout the day he was thoughtful and abstracted, and during the following weeks he was observed to act in the most unaccountable manner. On snowy evenings he would dodge out of the house without the slightest warning, and return shortly after with damp boots and a defeated air. Upon the streetcars, Mr. Broadstreet became famous that winter for his obliging manner and pleasant ways with the employees. Indeed, he more than once persisted in remaining on the platform with the conductor at the imminent risk of freezing his ears and nose until he was fairly driven within doors. Downtown he behaved still more queerly, leaving the office long before dark and being discovered in the oddest places imaginable, now diving into narrow courts and up steep staircases, now plunging into alleyways and no thoroughfares, and returning home late to dinner, greatly exhausted, with little or no money in his pockets. In these days, too, he began to talk about the sufferings of the poor, the abuses of the liquor law, the need of strong, pure women to go among the outcasts of our great troubled city and perform Christ-like deeds. One bitter cold night, he was much later than usual. It had been snowing heavily, and his wife had begun to worry a little over the absence of her husband when she heard the click of his key in the front door. When Mr. Broadstreet entered, sprinkled with snow from head to foot, what was her amazement to see him standing there with fur caps and glove and a glowing face, but no ulster.
"Alonso, Alonso," she cried from the head of the stairs, "what will you forget next? Where have you left it?"
"Why," he said simply, "I've found the discouraged man. And the doctor at the hospital says she will get well after all."
Well, friends, that's the end of our first holiday story. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Well, if you did enjoy it, feel free to support the show if you can. There's a link on the main website, that's forwardintothepastpodcast.com. Look for the yellow coffee cup at the bottom left corner, or the banner button marked Buy Me a Coffee. Please remember that I will continue to donate $1 back to Project Gutenberg for providing this and every story that I share with you on this podcast. I also make donations during this time of the year to a local cat rescue in the city where I live here in Central Florida. So, by supporting me, you will also indirectly support them as well. Isn't that nice? Well, as usual, I feel as if I've rambled long enough. Okay. Until next time, folks, thanks for listening, keep sharing the stories, and be a good human. Bye for now.